Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Micah chapter 4, which I will entitle The Mountain of the Lord. Now, this is going to be a good chapter because I think of all the prophets that I've looked at so far and all the chapters in those prophecies, it seems to me that this prophecy, this chapter, is the clearest indication that the prophets were testifying of the coming of the Messiah and the establishment of the new Zion, the New Testament church. Now, Micah, as I've said earlier in chapters 1 through 3, Micah was prophesying between 740 and 687 B.C. And remember, the Assyrians came in 722. The Babylonians came in 586. We need to remember those dates. So let's begin now in verse 1. And it will come about in the last days that the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and the peoples will stream to it. Now, the first three verses of Micah 4 are the same as Isaiah 2 through 4. So let me read you Isaiah 2:2-4 so you'll get a feel for it, and it will be a good preview for the chapter, Micah 4. Isaiah 2:2-4, "In the last days the mountain of the Lord's house will be established at the top of the mountains, and it will be raised above the hills. All nations will stream to it. And many peoples will come and say, 'Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways.'" And notice, the house of the God of Jacob, that's the temple. The mountain of the Lord is Zion. And the temple was on Mount Zion, or a subordinate peak of Mount Zion, Mount Moriah. "The Lord will teach us about his ways," Isaiah continues, "so that we may walk in his paths. For instruction will go out of Zion, and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will settle disputes among the nations and provide arbitration for many peoples. They will turn their swords into plows and their spears into pruning knives. Nations will not take up the sword against other nations, and they will never again train for war." Now, of course, that last verse is plastered on the side of the United Nations building because the secularists have stolen that verse from God, and they think, with their arbitration and their negotiation and their diplomacy, they're going to stop war. These are the same morons who put the head of Iran at the head of some council that's supposed to arbitrate for peace. I forgot the name of it. Iran, of course, is financing Hamas to destroy the state of Israel through terror. But, oh, the United Nations is going to turn everybody's swords into plows. Well, we know that can't be true. Well, we'll talk about what that means in just a minute as we go through this chapter. First, in verse 1, I want to look at this phrase, "in the last days." It will come about in the last days. Now, so many people being conditioned by futurists like Hal Lindsey and Tim LaHaye, as soon as they see that phrase, "last days," they think, oh, it's the end of the world. No, it's not the end of the world. Let me give you some scriptures that show you that the last days means the last days of the Jewish order and the beginning of time for the days of the Messiah. 1 Corinthians 10:11, and by the way, this is not just my view, this is the view of Adam Clark and John Gill. 1 Corinthians 10:11, "Now these things happened to them as examples to the Jews," Old Testament Jews, as examples, talking about the Exodus and so forth, "and they were written as a warning to us on whom the ends of the ages have come." So Paul clearly knew that the Old Testament order was ending, because the New Testament order with Jesus at the head of the church had begun. Hebrews 1:2, first part of the verse. "In these last days, he," the Father, "has spoken to us by his Son." Has spoken. It's already happened. When the author of Hebrews, who wrote sometime mid-60s, he says in these last days that he was living in, mid-60s, that's not the end of the world. Hebrews 9:26, second part of the verse. "But now he has appeared one time at the end of the ages." Well, did Jesus appear at the end of the world? No, he's appearing to the Jewish Christians in Jerusalem, the audience of the author of the book of Hebrews. "But now he has appeared one time at the end of the ages for the removal of sin by the sacrifice of himself." Jesus died on the cross at the end of the ages, the end of the Old Testament Jewish age, to be more precise. 1 John 2:18, "Children, it is the last hour." And if, as you have heard, the last hour, it is the last hour. John, of course, was writing sometime before the 2nd century B.C., not at the end of the world. "It is the last hour, and as you have heard, Antichrist is coming." Now, my opinion, the Antichrist was the evil emperor Nero. And by the way, that verb there, is coming, is in present tense. It's a present, middle, or passive indicative tense, not a future tense. It doesn't say Antichrist will come. Now, sometimes in English we use that phrase in the present to mean the future, like I am going to the store tomorrow. What it means is I'm in the process of getting ready to go to the store tomorrow. If you think about it, and Antichrist is coming, that means he's in the process of coming now. And then John continues, even now many Antichrists have come. We know from this that it is the last hour. The last hour is now. That's not the end of the world. That's when John was writing, pre-2nd century AD. Now, of course, the futurists ignore all that, and they say that the last days refers to the millennium, as Guzik does, my dispensationalist commentator. Well, you take your choice on that one. Of course, if you're not a pre-mill like Guzik is, you could still be a futurist amill, for example, and think that the last days refers to the end of the world when Jesus comes back, even though there's no intervening quote-unquote millennium. Well, I'm going to take this phrase in Micah 4:1, the last days, as talking about the end of the Jewish age and the beginning of the age when Messiah Jesus rules the church. And I think I can back that up as we go through this chapter. Isaiah 2:2 has similar expressions concerning the last days. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's house will be established. So that phrase, last days, is very key. And unfortunately, our brains have been hollowed out by the futurist eschatological enthusiast, the dispensationalist, who cannot conceive of any other possibility or any other eschatological scheme but their own. And I think it's a crying shame, really. Because if you put this Micah chapter 4 in the millennium, that means all of these blessings in this chapter skip right over your head and my head, over the church's head, because the church then becomes an empty parenthesis, a gap, plan B. God really was trying to establish a Jewish kingdom. He wasn't trying to establish the church. Well, I'm going to interpret this chapter as God trying and prophesying about establishing the church. In the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. Well, what is that mountain? Well, before we get into what it is, we need to point out that it's quite ironic. In the very last verse before this, in the last verse in chapter 3, Micah had prophesied that Jerusalem was going to be a wilderness. And then right here he says, but now in the last days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be established as the chief of the mountains. It's a big change. Let me read you that last verse in Micah 3. Therefore, because of you, referring to the people of Israel, Zion will be plowed like a field. Jerusalem will become ruins, and the hill of the Temple Mount will be a thicket. So in Micah 3:12, Mount Zion is a thicket, woods, weeds, and now in the very next verse, Micah 4:1, it's the chief mountain over all the earth. Well, this fits right in with the scheme of most of these prophets. They preach hellfire and damnation against the people of God before their sins, and then they say, but because of the covenant promise, there's going to be a remnant left, and then God's going to bring it all back according to his promise. And of course, how he does that is he established the Church of Christ. The nation of Israel was not meant to rule over the whole earth. It was meant to be the place of incubation for the Messiah, who then would start his kingdom, his spiritual kingdom, which would then bring sons of Abraham, both Jew and Gentile, into it from all corners of the earth. That's how God kept his covenant promises alive. Now let's look at some scholarly options as to what this mountain of the house of the Lord will be. Barnes says it's Jesus himself. I don't think so. Cambridge and Poole says it's Jerusalem. Zion is a synecdoche for Jerusalem. The mountain is a synecdoche for Jerusalem. Zion's not mentioned in verse 1, but it obviously refers to Zion. Well, that's true. The mountain is a synecdoche for Jerusalem, but is that what is being talked about here? Is that it? The chief of the mountains? Since when did Jerusalem become chief mountain over the whole world? I don't think so. Colin Delitzsch says it's rather Mount Moriah. Mount Moriah, of course, was a subordinate peak of Mount Zion, right to the north of the little hill there in Jerusalem that was called Zion. But you got the same problem there. Really, is that what is being talked about here? Well, the answer is, in my humble opinion, the mountain of the Lord is the Church of Christ. Now, Matthew Poole agrees with that. So does the pulpit commentary. Let me read you from Poole first. The mountain on which the temple did stand, called the house of the Lord, the hieroglyphic of the Church of Christ in gospel times. I like that expression, the hieroglyphic. I guess if you look at the symbol, the hieroglyph, and you look at that temple is like a hieroglyph on a stone somewhere, and you read it and you say, ah, that's the church. Here's what the pulpit's commentary says. The prophet speaks as if he contemplated a physical change, expressing thereby with singular force the notion that the worship of the true God, of which the temple was the symbol, shall be promulgated among all nations of the world, that from the old Jewish center of religion a new order of things shall arise, not transitory nor local, but extending to all time and pervading the utmost parts of the earth. And I think Pulpit is exactly right. This mountain here is the Church of Jesus Christ. Of course, the original reference is to Mount Zion, which is where the house of God was. But we see in the New Testament, in Hebrews 12, verse 22, Mount Zion is a symbol of the church. Let me read that for you. Instead, you have come to Mount Zion. Now, the author of the book of Hebrews is writing to Christian Jews. Instead, you have come to Mount Zion. That means you've come to the church. To the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. The heavenly Jerusalem, as opposed to the Jerusalem on earth, that's the church. To myriads of angels in festive gathering. All right, so I think we can say with a great deal of certainty that the mountain of the house of the Lord is Mount Zion, as type, at least. And then as fulfillment, it's the church of Jesus Christ. It will be the chief of the mountains because it will be the number one thing on earth. It will be raised above the hills. It will be exalted, and the peoples will stream to it. That's a pretty good description of the billions of Christians who have come into the church since this prophecy was given. It ought to encourage us, too, as we see all the evil that's in the world. Christians every day are streaming into the church. We go down to Micah chapter 4, verses 2 through 3. And many nations will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us about his ways so that we may walk in his paths. For instruction will go out of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will settle disputes among many peoples and provide arbitration for strong nations that are far away. They will beat their swords into plows and their spears into pruning knives. Nation will not take up the sword against nation, and they will never again train for war. Now in verse 2, Micah says, many nations will come and say, nations, that means Gentiles, that means people who aren't Jews. This verse shows that the gospel is universal. Salvation is not just tied to the Jews. And it's so ironic that the great problem that the early church had was trying to make the Jews see that the gospel was for the Gentiles. Remember all that kerfluffle that Peter had when he went up to Caesarea to preach to the Gentiles? He had to go back and justify it to the elders in Jerusalem, Acts 10 and 11. The Jews had a hard time with that. But if they just read their own scriptures, they would see the universal scope of the gospel. I guess they don't believe in the gospel. They would see the universal scope of Old Testament prophecy. Many nations will come and say. And of course, as Poole says, the gospel is the ultimate fulfillment of this as the nations stream into the church. Now, Poole says there are some typical fulfillments that predate the ultimate fulfillment of nations streaming into the church. Let's look at three suggestions that he gives. Typical fulfillment number one. This prophecy is fulfilled when so many proselyted and circumcised servants of several nations amassed in the Babylonish kingdom left their native country and in love to their Jewish masters and more to the God of the Jews and his law came up with them to Jerusalem and the temple. And so Poole says that many nations streamed back into Jerusalem when proselytes and servants of the Jews came back with them back into Jerusalem. Well, I don't know about that. That's an interesting idea. Poole also mentions a influx of nations into Zion, into Jerusalem, described in the book of Esther. Quote, when the wonderful deliverance of the Jews and the advancement of their countryman Mordecai in the Persian court brought the people and their religion into request and credit. Many turned Jews through the 127 provinces. They were circumcised. They became proselytes of righteousness. We read about that in Esther 8:17. In every province and every city, wherever the king's command and his law reached, joy and rejoicing took place among the Jews. You recall the story, of course, that there was an unfortunate edict issued against the Jews in the Persian Empire. This is somewhere in the 480s, I think it was, 5th century B.C. And King Xerxes, the Persian king, couldn't revoke that edict. And King Xerxes, the Persian king, could not revoke that edict. So he issued another edict and said that the Jews could whack anybody that was trying to whack them, which put terror amongst everybody in the empire about the Jews. Now, going back to Esther 8:17, there was a celebration and a holiday, and many of the ethnic groups of the land professed themselves to be Jews because fear of the Jews had overcome them. And so then, not the geographical Mount Zion, but the nation of Israel received some influx of people after that incident. I really think that's a stretch myself, but I will mention it to you. Typical fulfillment number 3, according to Poole. This prophecy was partly fulfilled when Ishmaelites, Moabites, Ammonites, and Idumeans submitted to the Maccabees, and by Hyrcanus' command, he was around 100 B.C., he was a Maccabean, and by Hyrcanus' command and with their own consent, the Idumeans were circumcised. So Idumeans came into the nation, but those are so small. I am more conservative in interpreting types than Poole is here. I don't think those are types. I think it's just easier to say that the nations will stream into the church. Now notice that the Lord Yahweh will teach us about his ways so that we may walk in his path. For instruction will go out of Zion and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. The word of the Lord, that's the gospel. Barnes, quoting Jerome, tells us that Jerome said this, "The word of God passed from Jerusalem to the Gentiles." Joseph Benson says this, "This streaming unto the Mountain of the Lord is a prophecy which was to be fulfilled by the coming of the Messiah, when the believing Gentiles were to be admitted into covenant with God, and the apostles were to preach the gospel." So the word going out was the gospel. Colin Delitzsch says this, "All this, however incredible it might appear, not only for the Israel of that time, but even now under the Christian dispensation, will assuredly take place, for the mouth of Jehovah the true God has spoken it." Now that's an interesting observation by Colin Delitzsch. I'm sure that the Jews were not thinking of themselves as being able to conquer the world, especially after Micah just said they were going to be plowed like a field. Well, we have the same problem reading this prophecy, because in verse 3 we see that Yahweh will settle disputes, provide arbitration for strong nations. The nations will beat their swords into plows and their spears into pruning knives. In other words, they're not going to fight anymore. Nation will not take up the sword against nation. They will never again train for war. That's hard for us to believe, as we live in the midst of war all the time. Right now as I speak, there's a war in Ukraine versus Ukraine and Russia. There's a war in Israel between the Jew-hating Hamas terrorist and Israel. And so it's hard for us to conceive of this. Well, the Jews, I'm sure, had just as hard a time listening to Micah back then and believing him as we might have today. This beating of swords into plows, or plowshares as the King James has it, it hasn't happened yet. Messiah's kingdom has not been consummated yet, as John Gill says. But it will one day, and when that happens, there will be peace in the world. God is not going to lead this world to war. He's not going to do it. Now, of course, the futurists, the pre-mill dispensationalists like Guzik, say that all this is going to happen in the millennium, and we're going to get to miss it. The church will get to miss this. Well, I will leave that to those of you who would like to dispute eschatology. I will just say this, at some time, because of the nations streaming into the church, there's going to be peace on this earth. I am a postmillennialist. I believe it will happen as the gospel spreads. We go now to Micah 4, verse 4. "And each of them will sit under his vine." Each of them means each of the peoples of the nations. "Will sit under his vine and under his fig tree, with no one to make them afraid, for the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken." Now, why would someone want to sit under his vine and under his fig tree? Well, that would be in the open. This person would feel total safety. He doesn't need to be in his house, hunkered down, like the Jews were in the kibbutzes down there near the Gaza Strip, when they went into their safe rooms and hunkered down, while the baby-killing, rapist, murdering Hamas terrorists came in. The Jews, many of them, tried to get into the safe houses. Of course, a lot of times it didn't work, but many of them were saved from the terrorist onslaught. They wouldn't be sitting out there under their vine and their fig tree, so this is a symbol of peace. No wars, because people are sitting under a vine, taking their ease in the cool summer evening. No one's going to make them afraid. Why? Because the mouth of the Lord of hosts has spoken. Of course, that's anthropomorphic. God doesn't have a mouth. But God has spoken, as he says, there's not going to be any more fighting, guys. Micah 4, verses 5 through 8. Though all the peoples each walk in the name of their gods, we will walk in the name of Yahweh our God forever and ever. On that day, this is the Lord's declaration, I will assemble the lame and gather the scattered, those I have injured. I will make the lame into a remnant, those far removed into a strong nation. Then the Lord will rule over them in Mount Zion from this time on and forever. And you, watchtower for the flock, that's referring to Jerusalem, fortified hill of daughter Zion, again, Jerusalem, the former rule will come to you. Sovereignty will come to daughter Jerusalem. Now in verse 5, Yahweh says, even though all the peoples walk in the name of their gods, actually Micah says, we will walk in the name of Yahweh. Now, unlike the Gentiles, after the Babylonian captivity, the Jews never worshipped idols again. To this very day, they don't worship idols. So there was a purging there. Now in verse 6, Yahweh says he is going to assemble the lame and gather the scattered. Options as to what this assembly might be. The assembling of Christians into the Christian church, according to Adam Clark, John Gill, Albert Barnes, and Colin Delitch. Guzik, the futurist, the dispensationalist, says it's the gathering of believers in the millennial kingdom. Ellicott says it's the gathering of the Jews returning from Babylon, circa 538 after Cyrus's decree. But, of course, that could be a type of assembly into the Christian church. And again, since that's the tack I'm taking on this chapter, we will walk in the name of Yahweh our God forever and ever in the Christian church under the lordship of Jesus the Messiah. Jesus will assemble the lame and gather the scattered, those he has injured. He injured them when he consigned them to exile by the Babylonians in 586, I believe is what they're talking about. Benson and Poole say that, and I believe they're right. So yeah, God injured the Old Testament Jews, but then he's going to bring them back, and as a type, he's going to establish them in Jerusalem again, and that Mount Zion will then be a type of the new Mount Zion, the mountain of the Lord, the church, into which God will assemble everyone, the lame and the scattered. Verse 7, I will make the lame into a remnant, those far removed into a strong nation. In other words, those who were scattered into exile, they come back into Jerusalem, and they become a strong nation. Then the Lord will rule over them in Mount Zion from this time on and forever, all the way through the time of the New Testament church age. Verse 8, and you, watchtower for the flock. That's Jerusalem, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, and Clark. Jerusalem oversees the flock spiritually. Now, Jerusalem includes the New Jerusalem, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, the church, because the church now watches over the flock, not just Jerusalem. And you, watchtower for the flock, fortified hill of daughter Zion. And that is a confusing translation to me. So let me read you Micah 4:8. You, Jerusalem, watchtower of the flock, stronghold of the people of Zion. Your former government will come back to you. The kingdom will return to the people of Jerusalem. The term daughter is often used for the population of a place. The daughter of Jerusalem is the population of Jerusalem. So why not just translate it that way, is the way God's word does it? The kingdom will return to the people of Jerusalem. You could say to the daughter of Jerusalem, but the Holman Christian Study Bible says to daughter Jerusalem, which is even more confusing. The former rule, in other words, your former sovereignty, when you rule the land yourself, Jerusalem, is going to come back. But again, all this is fulfilled in the church. And there's so many people today under the influence of dispensationalism who say that, oh, yes, the rule's coming back to that geopolitical entity at the eastern end of the Mediterranean Sea. And as much as I love those people, and I do not believe that that's what Micah has in view here. Now, I've already said this once, but I'm going to say it again to emphasize it. Verse 7, the Lord will rule over this assembly of people that he's gathered, he will rule over them in Mount Zion. Mount Zion is a symbol of the New Testament church. We know that because we read in Hebrews 12:22, instead you have come to Mount Zion. This is the author of the book of Hebrews speaking to Christians. You have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem. That's the church. We go down to Micah 4, verses 9 through 13, and we will finish this chapter. Micah says, now why are you shouting loudly? Is there no king with you? Has your counselor perished so that anguish grips you like a woman in labor? Writhe and cry out, daughter Zion, or daughter of Zion, or people of Zion, people of Jerusalem. Writhe and cry out like a woman in labor, for now you will leave the city and camp in the open fields. That's what exiles do. They're forced out of the city where it's safe, and they have to go into the open fields, either as they run from the invading armies or they're captured by the invading armies. You will go to Babylon. There you will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the power of your enemies. Many nations have now assembled against you. They say, let her be defiled, and let us feast our eyes on Zion. But they do not know the Lord's intentions or understand his plan, that he has gathered them like sheaves to the threshing floor. Rise and thresh, daughter Zion, for I will make your horns iron and your hooves bronze, so you can crush many peoples. Then you will set apart their plunder to the Lord for destruction, their wealth to the Lord of all the earth. Now Micah says, why are you shouting loudly? He's referring to the coming disaster. He refers it to Babylon in verse 10, which we'll talk about in a minute. And I need to point out that a lot of times, since Micah could be prophesying before the Assyrians came in, that it's possible that he's referring to the Assyrian invasion in 722. Micah prophesied between 740 and 687, so he could have been prophesying either before or after that invasion. And the commentators tend to disagree on that. But here he mentions Babylon by name. We'll talk about that in a minute. Is there no king with you, says Micah, like when Zedekiah was captured by the Babylonians right around 586 and carried off into exile into Babylon? There was no king, all right. Has your counselor perished? Asked Micah. That would refer to possibly prophets or maybe the king's counselors. They're gone. So that anguish grips you like a woman in labor? Apparently the Old Testament people had not heard of the Lamaze method of giving birth, where mothers do not have to writhe in anguish when they give birth. Verse 10, writhe and cry out, daughter Zion. Writhing, that sounds like the woman trying to give birth. People of Jerusalem, daughter of Zion, like a woman in labor. So you're going to camp in the open fields, you will go to Babylon. Now, the fact that Micah predicted the Babylonian captivity has caused some concern amongst people who have trouble believing prophecy. The Babylonian captivity was in 586, and Micah was long dead by 586. The last possible date that he could have prophesied was 687. We learned that from Micah 1:1. It tells us during whose king's reign he prophesied, and so we can nail the dates down. So prophesying about something so far in advance means that only a prophet could have seen this. Politically, at the time that Micah was prophesying, the only empire on the horizon was Assyria. Well, to get around that problem, some scholars say that Babylon is the province of Assyria that Micah is talking about here. This is from the Cambridge Commentary. You will go to the province of Babylon in Assyria. So Micah is predicting what anybody could see at that time, which would make him an historian rather than a prophet. Or it could make him a political pundit rather than a prophet. I don't think this is true. I think this is some liberal nonsense, liberals who can't believe prophecy. Why would Micah predict an exile to one tiny little province? And why wouldn't Micah just say Assyria if he meant Assyria? Why say Babylon? Just to confuse people. No, I think it's the province of Babylon. He prophesied it. You will go to Babylon, there you will be rescued. And that, of course, would refer to the time of Cyrus's decree, which is in 539 BC. Cyrus the Persian beat the Babylonians and said, okay, Jews, the Babylonians are gone. You can go back to your nation. You will be rescued. There the Lord will redeem you from the power of your enemies. Redemption means buy you out of slavery. And so redeem means to take you out of slavery to the Babylonians and send you back to Jerusalem, where you will have your former authority. Verse 11, many nations have now assembled against you. They say, let her be defiled, and let us feast our eyes on Zion. Well, here are four options as to who these nations that have gathered against Zion, against Israel. We need to remember that these nations, in verse 12, will be gathered like sheaves. And then in verse 13, the people of Jerusalem will thresh these nations. Okay, that's important. So who are these nations? Who are these sheaves on the threshing floor? Option number one, this is affirmed by Adam Clark. The nations are the Babylonians and their subject peoples and their allies. Allies such as Edom, Ammon, and Syria. So they're your nations. And they got threshed when the Medes and the Persians under Cyrus wiped them out right around 539 BC. The problem with that is that verse 13 says that Zion is going to thresh these nations, and that would mean Zion is going to thresh Babylonia. And when did Zion do that? It was the Persians that did it, not Israel. So Gill denies this option. Now you could say, well, Israel did it sort of in a secondary sense. They worshiped Yahweh. Yahweh controls Persia, and Persia wiped out Babylon. But that's somewhat of a stretch. So here's option number two as to who these nations who are going to be threshed, these sheaves that are going to be threshed on the threshing floor. The Assyrians, the pulpit commentary affirms this option. The Assyrian armies were composed of various nationalities, of course. So if you were attacked by Assyria, you were attacked by nations. And we need to ask the next question, when did the Assyrians attack? Well, they attacked northern Israel in, of course, 722, but also in the time of Sennacherib around 701 when the Assyrians attacked Hezekiah in Jerusalem. And according to this option, if the nations that attack the people of Israel are the Assyrians, and again, I have a problem with that because Babylon is mentioned explicitly in verse 10, but if they are the Assyrians, then they would get threshed when the Babylonians wiped the Assyrians out in 612 when Nineveh fell. Again, the problem with that is verse 13 says that Zion is going to thresh the nations, not to mention that Babylon is mentioned in verse 10. So we go to option 3. This is from John Gill. It's not Assyria. It's not Babylon. It's not option 1, Babylon, not Assyria, option 2. It's option 3, the Maccabeans, the enemies of the Maccabeans, petty enemies of the Maccabeans, whoever it was that the Maccabeans were fighting. And I'm not an expert on the Maccabean times, but of course they beat the Seleucids, probably Arab tribes in the neighborhood trying to attack the Maccabeans. Many nations will now be assembled against you. That's the and that's the enemies of the Maccabees. That's what John Gill says. I have a hard time believing that. Well then, what's the answer? Well, I think that Joseph Benson has the answer. Option number 4. The nations that are going to come against Mount Zion are the nations that are opposed to the Church of Jesus Christ in the New Testament. God's going to gather those nations, and they're going to succumb to the advance of the gospel. And so Zion will have a spiritual victory over the nations. Now let me read you Benson's comment. He says, this might be spoken of the victories which the Jewish people, sometime after their return, were to gain over the neighboring nations, especially under the Maccabees and their successors. So he gives lip service to John Gill's view that the nations coming up against the Jews that are going to get threshed were the Maccabees, were the enemies of the Maccabees. Benson continues, but the prophecy does not appear to have had a full accomplishment in these victories, nor has any event yet occurred in the history of the Jewish people which fully answers to it. This consideration has induced some commentators to expound the passage in a spiritual sense, namely, of bringing the Gentiles into subjection to Christ in his gospel, and of the victory which the Christian church should obtain over her persecuting enemies after the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine to the faith of Christ. And I think Benson's right. Micah was prophesying about the spiritual conquest of the new Zion, the spiritual Zion, the new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, the Church of Jesus Christ. Now, in verse 13, Micah says, rise and thresh, people of Zion, people of Jerusalem, for I will make your horns iron. Of course, the horn was the strength of an animal, and if it's made out of iron, that's doubly strong. Your hooves bronze, that's so you can stomp on people with bronze hoofs. Your hoofs won't shatter. They'll crush. And an objector might say, well, that's somewhat martial imagery for the church conquering the nations. I don't know. When you consider how much the nations hate the Church of Jesus Christ today, I don't know. I think that the imagery is comforting to me. Now, in the last part of 13, verse 13, we read, then you will set apart their plunder to the Lord for destruction. Now, that's a one-off translation. Set aside their plunder for destruction. Because you think, well, why in the world would any nation get plunder from another nation and then destroy it? To prove my point, let me read you other translations of the second part of Micah 4:13. This is the ASV. I will devote their gain unto Jehovah. No mention of destruction. Bible in Basic English. You will give up their increase to the Lord. God's Word. You will claim their loot for the Lord. KJV. I will consecrate their gain unto the Lord. New American Bible. You should devote their spoils to the Lord. NASB. You may devote to the Lord their unjust gain. Young's Literal Translation. I have devoted to Jehovah their gain. Not one mention of destruction, so we can wipe that out. Now, the wealth goes to the Lord of all the earth as the nations are conquered. What does that mean? Options. Option number 1. The daughter of Zion, the inhabitants of Zion, received this wealth when Cyrus gave permission for the Jews to carry their temple implements back in circa 539 BC. Well, the permission was given in 539, and they brought it back, brought all that gold and silver back somewhere around the next year or so. But the problem again with that is the wealth was to be carried back, and the people who had stolen the wealth were to be threshed. And as I said earlier, when was Babylon threshed by Zion? Didn't happen. Unless you want to say that Judah, through Yahweh, threshed Babylon because they got freed from Babylon, went to their homeland of Israel, and then they prayed to Yahweh, and then the Persians came in and threshed Babylon. But that's a big, big, big stretch. Option number two, when did this wealth come back into Zion? John Gill says it's when the Maccabees restored from the surrounding nations the wealth that the nations had plundered from Israel. That would be all of Palestine, Moab. Palestine is where the Philistines were. Moab, Edomia, that's Edom, Samaria, Iturea, right to the north of Jerusalem, as Josephus relates. I don't think so. Guzik says all this wealth will come back into Zion in the millennium. Well, that's a nice speculation. I don't know how in the world he proves it. I have trouble believing that this millennium even exists because I'm not pre-mill. So let's look at option number four. This is from Joseph Benson. The substance of the nations was consecrated to the Lord Jesus. Again, that's somewhat of a symbolic interpretation, but that is the interpretation I have given of Micah chapter 4. I hope you like it. If you don't, I can't prove you wrong, because you can't prove anybody wrong using the words of these prophecies. You can always speculate, oh, it's the millennium, oh, it's the future state, because the prophets were just ambiguous enough to make us want to look and search. Remember that famous verse in Peter? They searched the prophecies of old to see what this redemption could mean. Well, we're finished searching for today. We're now ready to go to Micah chapter 5, which I will call the ruler to be born in Bethlehem. I wonder who that was. I think we can all agree on that one at least. So I hope you stay tuned for our next audio as we celebrate the coming of Jesus the Messiah. I hope you enjoyed this audio too.